Welcome, everybody, to episode 85 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family doc and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, another family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. We are recording on the eve of Labor Day weekend, the traditional end of summer, although we know that the astronomical summer is later in the week. We hope that all of you, if you're traveling, that you have safe travels and that you have a healthy weekend and an enjoyable and restful time with your families and friends.
Thanks, Henry. On this podcast, we highlight poems, patient-oriented evidence that matters. To get all of them, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get a poem every day in your email, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 diseases and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at www.essentialevidenceplus.com. Why do I still say the www? Just not necessary. The opinions expressed on the Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent sound medical advice, even unsound medical advice, or the endorsement of any product. For a nominal annual fee, you can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Go to IAFP.com, click on their IAFP education webpage button, and find the podcast. And they don't give us any of the money from the CME. I just want to point that out. We never asked, and they never sent us a check. So there you go. Okay, this week we're going to talk about comparative. I'm a little punchy because I just drove 15 hours. This week we're going to discuss comparative efficacy of aspirin doses, blood pressure lowering and health outcomes, dosing of antidepressants, and a really weird treatment for migraine using eye drops. Kate, why don't you tell us about the first poem?
I would be happy to tell you about this first poem. So this is a study from the New England Journal of Medicine done by Dr. Jones and colleagues talking about the dose of aspirin when used for secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease. So we know that there's a role there, even as we're finding that there are fewer indications for primary prevention. But the question really does remain, what is the dose of aspirin that people with known cardiovascular disease should take? Is it low dose, so baby aspirin at 81 milligrams, or full dose at 325 milligrams? This study was sponsored by PCORI, and it set out to answer whether one dose is either safer or clinically better than the other dose. So the study randomized more than 15,000 patients with cardiovascular disease to either 81 milligrams or 325 milligrams of aspirin every day. The average age of the patients was 67 and a half. About 70% were men and about 80% identified as white. Most of them had been using aspirin prior to the trial, which makes sense. The primary efficacy outcome was your typical composite of major cardiovascular events, all-cause mortality, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke. The primary safety outcome was major bleeding requiring a blood transfusion. And patients were followed for an average of about 26 months. So safety first, 53 patients in the baby aspirin group and 41 in the full dose group had a major bleed requiring transfusion, which was not statistically significant. 529 patients in the baby aspirin group and 569 in the full dose group experienced one of those composite outcomes. This was also not significant. So all that said, they're sounding pretty equivalent, but 40% of patients in the 325 milligram group switched doses to the baby aspirin at some point, which suggests that there was either a clinician or a patient preference for the lower dose. And this is interesting. So the article mentioned that in 2014, 60% of US patients were taking 325 milligrams, but the article's switch rate suggests that there's now a much stronger preference for the lower dose. They suggested that that might have been influenced by European guidelines, which came out in 2019, which specifically recommend low-dose aspirin for secondary prevention. They define low doses between 81 and 100 milligrams. So I thought this was an interesting one to talk about. Henry, what do you think?
So I was always taught that you give 81 milligrams for coronary artery disease prevention and 325 milligrams for stroke prevention. And it's not clear in this study that this was stroke secondary prevention. So maybe that still needs some further discussion. I think a lot of this could be a reflection of, you alluded to the primary prevention issues that, you know, in modern era, where fewer people smoke. We're more aggressive about treating hypertension and hyperlipidemia, that maybe even in secondary prevention, lower dose aspirin may in fact be adequate. Now, I do have to make one final comment that this is maybe an old comment, but you know, we know that aspirin has some anti-inflammatory properties, and but still many people think that aspirin's primary effect is on platelet inhibition, which leads to the comment that you probably really only need to take aspirin on the morning before you have your heart attack.
Well, good to know. I'll try to remember that when I have my heart attack. So just for listeners, PCORI, those folks who aren't in the research world, is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. It was established by the Obamacare Affordable Care Act, and they were intended to fund lots of primary care research. At least that's kind of what we thought they were going to do when they say things like patient-centered outcomes. But they mostly fund, you know, research on obscure diseases. But this is one of the few studies they've funded that I've seen that has actually addressed a good primary care question. So well done, PCORI. Unfortunately, it was kind of a pragmatic trial with all these crossovers to kind of muddy it. And if they used all-cause mortality, that's also going to muddy things, because most of the things people die of have nothing to do with aspirin. So that's going to create some issues in the power, in the statistical power. But anyway, baby aspirin for me, when I have my heart attack, or just before I have my heart attack.
The day of.
Okay, I'll put it on the calendar. Kate, you got a quiz for us today.
I sure do. So coffee has been maligned, although not on this podcast, and praised for its health risks and benefits. Which of the following statements is true regarding coffee consumption and cardiac arrhythmias? A, the incidence of arrhythmias increases with more than 6 ounce cups per day. B, coffee consumption has no effect on the incidence of arrhythmias. C, the incidence of cardiac arrhythmias increases linearly with each cup of coffee. D, the incidence of cardiac arrhythmias decreases with increasing coffee consumption. Stay tuned for the answer.
Okay, thanks, Kate. And I think we'll have a good discussion around this one. Interesting. And anyway, I should explain, John was originally going to be with us. We recorded this Wednesday. We had technical difficulties. We're re-recording, and he's nowhere to be found. We don't know where he is. He's actually at the U.S. Open watching tennis. So he is alive. We promise he'll be back for the next podcast. Henry, what about blood pressure lowering and the extent of blood pressure lowering? How important is that for folks with and without cardiovascular disease?
So this is a paper by Rahimi and colleagues on behalf of the Blood Pressure Lowering Treatment Trialists Collaboration, published in Lancet in May. And this is a messy paper, so stay with me a little bit. I apologize for some of the complexities. So this was, first of all, a large collaborative group of investigators who represented multiple clinical trials. And they pooled together to try to get all of the data, the patient-level data, and do a variation on meta-analyses. So they, first of all, they identified from multiple databases and registries randomized trials to lower blood pressure in patients with hypertension. They included pretty much every comparison you could imagine: placebo, other classes of blood pressure medications, more intensive versus less intensive. But the one thing that they didn't include were specific blood pressure targets. Now, the studies had to have at least 1,000 person years of follow-up in each wing, so basically larger studies. And as you might imagine, with all of the various comparisons, they have lots of methodologic heterogeneity in the trials. Now, they didn't say this outright, but kind of buried in their statistical analysis, they made mention of using the Cochrane risk of bias tool. So they did assess the risk of bias of the included studies. And then they did a secondary analysis, a sensitivity analysis, where they excluded 4 of the trials that were high risk. So really try to see what we get from the best quality studies. So overall, they had 48 trials with over 340,000 participants. Roughly 187,000 had no previous coronary vascular disease, and about 158,000 had previous CVD. They had an average of 4 years of follow-up, and during that time period, just over 12% had at least one major adverse cardiac event. Now, here's where the numbers get a little bit confusing, but stick with me a little bit. So first of all, among those that did not have cardiovascular disease at baseline, the rate of MACE in the comparison group was slightly higher than those who got the intervention. So 32 per thousand versus 26 per thousand. And that was comparable to those that had CVD at baseline, although that was a little bit narrower, 40 versus 36. So the author said that they didn't find any heterogeneity, but didn't, they claimed it, but they didn't provide any data in that or in their supplement. But I found some of their figures that showed a bubble plot of the individual study data. And frankly, it looked like it was all over the map. So I'm not sure that I trust their claim, although pooling of the individual data can address some of this. So when they slice and dice their data, they identified seven different systolic blood pressure strata and said that they found relative uniformity in the degree of reduction in MACEs across each of those. So roughly a 10% relative mortality reduction for every five millimeter lowering of systolic blood pressure. So, and this was consistent whether or not they had baseline cardiovascular disease. So for me, this was a messy study. A 10% relative reduction is not a really impressive reduction based on individual level decision-making. But if you think about it across a population, it has the potential for affecting a large number of people. Now, the authors go on and say that maybe we should modify our guidelines and that they need to be updated based on this. Now, I got a problem with that. First of all, how many daggone updates have we had in the last 5 years? And frankly, the messiness in some of their comparison groups, and I'm concerned about some of the potential for cherry picking of outcomes and the like, and the inconsistency, just make me concerned about the veracity of some of their claims. A couple of years ago, we did a poem on a paper that evaluated the incremental benefits of changing blood pressure definitions, and that raised a lot of questions, and I would encourage you to take a look at that. And then finally, in the Public Library of Science Medicine meta-analysis about a year ago, they found that stratifying patients based on cardiovascular risk was much more effective than using blood pressure levels alone. Mark.
Yeah, that was quite a long one. That's a lot there.
Yeah.
And you know, I think when they do an individual patient data meta-analysis, they tend to worry less about heterogeneity inappropriately because they're glomming everything together. And then they look at confidence intervals and say, oh, look how precise our confidence intervals are. But that's just because they have a billion patients and they're looking at this narrow confidence interval and saying, oh, that means we don't have heterogeneity. You were correct to look at the bubble plot, which says, yeah, but each study individually, you know, they were quite different looking at each other. It was interesting that they, and also I think at one point you said the 10% reduction in mortality, I think it was a 10% reduction in MACE. So that's mortality is only one part of that. And I think most of the time when we look at a major adverse cardiovascular event outcome, a MACE, most of the benefit is fewer non-fatal MIs. A fairly small proportion of the benefit is lower mortality. So, you know, that's important too. Not that MIs are good, but, you know, at some point lowering the blood pressure to, you know, 70 over 50 just can't be a good idea. And, you know, there's a point at which of diminishing returns. And I still, you know, shoot for 140 over 90 for most of my patients. If somebody's lower, great, that's fine. If they feel good, and we've known from other studies that there are some harms of driving blood pressure too low for patients. Kate, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I do love talking about heterogeneity and different kinds in meta-analysis, but from a clinical implementation
seriously,
point of view,
let's talk about that some more. I don't think we've finished that.
From a clinical point of view, I worry a little bit that that were actually sort of complicating the useful takeaways from some of these hypertension trials by being more and more aggressive when there are some key points and about treating hypertension, which is that if you have very high blood pressure, that needs to be treated. And now we're starting to confuse that when we get into the sort of gray zone where we don't really know when to stop treating high blood pressure, when to, and instead of just saying, these are the areas where we don't really know with as much confidence. And if we start to incorporate these into guidelines, as we have started to do, that we're going to start to do more harm than good, because people are going to be able to point to this and say, well, we don't actually know this as well, which means I don't have to take my blood pressure pills at all. So I would like to see us sort of move to a place where we say, hey, here's what we know with a strong degree of confidence. If your blood pressure is very high, it should be treated. And here's what we don't know quite as confidently. So be ready for this evidence to change. Or here's where you need much more of a risk-benefit discussion that in addition to the heterogeneity discussion.
Great point. And I will we'll talk about heterogeneity some more later, though. Don't worry.
I can't wait.
Yeah, I can't wait. Okay, I'm going to talk about doses of antidepressants. Does increasing the dose of an antidepressant above the minimal dose improve outcomes? This was from Furukawa in Acta Psychiatrica Scandinavia 2020, volume 141, page 401. It's a meta-analysis. It was sponsored by the presumably Scandinavian government. I can't tell from the authors' names where they're from. It looks like they're from all over Europe. These authors, they searched 10 databases. Now, I didn't even know there were 10 databases to search. I can think of, okay, PubMed, Cochrane, CINAHL, maybe Web of Science, you know, then I run out. But they did that. They found 10 databases. They looked at the National Drug Licensing website to identify unpublished studies. They only included randomized trials, and they found 123 published and unpublished studies that enrolled over 29,000 patients. They included any study published in any language that evaluated SSRIs, venlafaxine, or mirtazapine for the acute treatment of major depression. Basically, they were studies that compared dosing at the minimum licensed dose of the drug or in a flexible dose regimen that allowed the physician to titrate the dose up over time. On average, patients had moderate to severe depression. A response was defined as a 50% or greater reduction from baseline on some depression severity scale. Overall, titrating above the minimum dose didn't further increase the likelihood of response for any of the treatments compared with just using the minimum dose. And sertraline did produce a better response on average with the minimum dose than some of the other drugs. Caveat, the studies were of short duration, typically a couple of months, which may not have been enough time to see if there was really a response to that titration. Patients taking venlafaxine may respond to a higher dose if they showed no response at the minimum dose. That was another one of their findings. There was moderate heterogeneity, and there was no evidence of publication bias or what we call small study effects. When you have a lot of studies, some of them are quite small, and those smaller studies tend to give more positive results. So bottom line, for newer generation antidepressants, initial titration over the first 8 weeks of treatment doesn't provide a benefit over starting with the minimum dose in patients with moderate to severe depression. So, you know, some folks were taught you start on this minimum dose and 2 weeks later, you talk to the patient. If they're not doing any better, you up the dose. And then 2 weeks after that, you might up the dose again. This suggests that maybe let's wait a little bit longer. Let's wait 6 to 8 weeks at that minimum dose before we think about upping the dose or perhaps switching to a different agent. Kate.
Yeah, I don't think the caveats is as big. I think a lot of the SSRI studies are usually done over the course of 8 weeks. So that seems okay to me in the grand scheme of things. My typical practice is to give it 4 weeks to begin with. So, you know, saying, well, we're going to try 8 weeks now feels doable to me. And if you've got a patient who is really no better in that time frame, you know, potentially looking at a different medicine instead of it is my practice to go ahead and try and increase the dose, but maybe not, you know, maybe giving it the full 8 weeks. I like the study. I think it's interesting, and this may be a practice change for me.
Yeah, I'd like to see more studies like this that look at some of these common practices that you know, really, I didn't think was all that well studied. Obviously, there have been a lot of studies I knew nothing about out there that they found. Henry?
Yeah, you don't know about them because they've been published in databases that you hadn't heard of.
There you go. Of course.
Yeah, so for old-timers like me who were raised with prescribing tricyclic antidepressants, in those days, the mantra was start low, go slow. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like it applies even to newer generation antidepressants. I want to point out two things. One is that this was patients with moderate to severe depression. And so we do need to make certain that even if we're not changing their treatment, we need to be have ongoing assessments of suicidality. And the third point is that for our patients with mild depression, I'm not aware of much data that suggests that any medication is really any more effective than exercise and counseling.
Well, yeah, I think that's true for mild depression. And I love the point you made. You know, we certainly are not saying don't see them for 6 weeks. That activation that can happen early on in some patients with depression can give them the energy to do self-harm. So we still need to be in close touch with these patients. Excellent point. So I'm going to quickly go over John's poem since he couldn't be here, but it was a really cool little study. This is a study from India, and they found 50 patients with migraines, and they randomized them to either timolol eye drops, 0.5% eye drops, or a placebo eye drop, which was just the vehicle. After a three-month treatment period, they did a crossover. So half the patients got the timolol, the other half got vehicle. Then they had a one-month washout period to let all those eye drops wash out of their eyes. And then they gave them the opposite treatment. And they did that for another 3 months. And seven patients dropped out, 43 patients completed the study, so not terrible. And they used just one drop at the earliest onset of migraine, and they repeated it at 10 minutes if necessary. The main outcome was reduction in pain score. And so interestingly, this study was 84% female patients. The mean age was 27 years. And of 619 migraine attacks, they treated about half with timolol and about just under half with placebo. And what they found was that in the timolol treated migraine attacks, their pain score went down by 4 points or to zero in 82% of the patients, compared with only 14% in the placebo. So 82% had a good response versus only 14% with placebo. Mean difference in pain was 4.6 out of 10 points, which is a big clinical response. So this would suggest that 0.1% timolol eye drops are a great treatment for acute migraine. I think it's such a novel treatment, and using eye drops like this can lead to hypotension, can lead to syncope. I've had that happen to a family member. And so, you know, I've seen somebody pass out and watch them fall on the floor after getting too much eye drop in. So it's not without potential harm. And I think we need to see another study, but I'm curious what you guys think about this one. Kate?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the crossover trial design. So the way that you feel about methodologic and statistical heterogeneity, that's how I feel about the crossover trial design. I just think it's clever how people act as their own controls. But this, I'm really here for this treatment too. Yes. You know, there a lot of the things that we have for migraine treatment, people either don't tolerate or they aren't candidates for whatever reason. So that migraine certainly very prevalent, can be, you know, incapacitating for people who suffer from them. So if this does, you know, turn out to be a treatment that is effective and is safe, as you point out, I'm ready for it. I share your concern that I maybe want to see another trial before I'm ready to make that decision. But yeah, I'm ready for it.
Yeah. And, you know, just to remind listeners, I'll nerd out for a bit, but, you know, crossover trials, as Kate said, that people serve as their own controls. So even though there are only 50 patients and 43 completed, that's a big crossover trial, actually. You can get a statistically and clinically significant response with 30 patients in a crossover trial, as opposed to needing 300 or 400. They're obviously not good for everything, but for something like this, where you have frequent episodic you know, episodes of pain, episodic episodes. So you have lots of episodes of pain. This is a great design for that kind of a study. And so I agree. This is potentially interesting. Henry, throw some cold water on us, please.
I will, give me a chance. So I too am a big fan of crossover trials for the reasons that both of you have addressed. I do want to point out that the International Headache Society has recommended among their patient-oriented outcomes that you look at a 50% reduction in pain intensity and total relief. And so this reduction in 4 points on a 10-point scale is pretty darn close to meeting that. I wonder, this translates into a number needed to treat of about 2. And I wonder if that's just too good to be true. And so for some of the reasons that you express, I think I'd love to see more studies. 20 minutes is not a lot of time. And we know from other treatments that there is that rebound headache that people get. And so this is probably not long enough to be able to detect that. And so I think not only do we need more studies to replicate, we also need longer term follow-up information.
Yeah, you have to wonder, did they get a great response at 20 minutes and then a terrible response at 1 hour, 2 hours, and 3 hours, and we're just not hearing about that. I'm not saying that at all that happened. I'm not trying to malign the researchers, but there have been evidence, you know, previous studies and other conditions where people have kind of cherry-picked the outcomes and said, oh, this is the best outcome. Let's pick this one. 20 minutes is kind of an odd outcome. So anyway, yeah, want to see more. Hope it works. That would be really cool. And we're ready for it. So Kate, you got the quiz answer for us?
Yes. Which of the following statements is true regarding coffee consumption and cardiac arrhythmias was the question. A, the incidence of arrhythmias increases. B, coffee consumption has no effect on the incidence. C, the incidence increases linearly. Or D, the incidence of cardiac arrhythmias decreases with increasing coffee consumption. So the correct answer is D.
No, that can't be.
Wait, I will tell you. According to this large prospective cohort study that included more than 386,000 people, it analyzed longitudinal data from the UK Biobank between January 1st of 2006 and December 31st of 2018. It was a mean follow-up of 4.5 years. About 16,000 people developed an incident arrhythmia. They adjusted for demographic characteristics, comorbid conditions, lifestyle habits. Each additional cup of habitual coffee, so daily coffee consumed, was associated with a 3% lower risk of incident arrhythmia. They had a hazard ratio of 0.97 with a statistically significant confidence interval. This held true for atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, and SVT. John said he's going to continue drinking 3 cups a day. I don't quite get that many in. So, you know, it's a large cohort. So as well done as they could have done it, you know, you always worry about the potential for unmeasured confounding in any cohort. You know, they mentioned all the things that they adjusted for. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, as we say this is from my lecture notes when I teach intro to epi, large observational studies can get the wrong answer with great precision. So having a huge number is super impressive. 386,000 patients in the biobank, that's great. But, and you know, they did the best they could with the data they had. But, you know, I also remember a study that we talked about before we recorded that, you know, there was an association found in an observational study between running, being a runner in middle and older age and having a lower risk of osteoarthritis. Well, of course, all the people that ruin their knees running in their 30s and 40s like me aren't running anymore. And so it's, you know, that's a huge potential selection bias here. So I would take it with a grain of salt. So put a little grain of salt in your coffee and then you'll be okay. Henry, final thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I agree. All those people who, when they drink coffee, they start having palpitations and stuff, they stop drinking. And so I think that's really what the issue is here, that there's largely self-selection.
Yeah. If you like coffee, drink coffee. I'm just finishing my cups, but that'll be it for the day for me. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Kate and Henry, for re-recording this session. It was fun as always. If you want CME credit, go to IAFP.com, click on online IAFP education. I'm not reading the damn CME thing because I'm tired of it. And John's not here. So there you go. I hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. We're going to talk to you soon with more primary care updates.